conspiracy that enabled us to be talking about very similar things during the course of this week. I would just like to say this, that I think that the Old Testament material that serves as background for a great deal of the New Testament materials, which David was talking about and others as well, has long been neglected in the life of the church. I think we've commonly thought that Jesus started everything brand new, and we forget that he was raised in a Jewish home and was immersed in the Old Testament, and that Jewish heritage framed his thinking, his preaching material in more ways than we can imagine. And issues of justice, I think, has been apparent this week, has been one very important connection between Jesus' own preaching and teaching and the Old Testament in which he was steeped. That's just one comment I'd like to suggest, is that the continuities between the Old Testament and the New Testament are much greater than we commonly imagine, and we need to lift that up for our attention more often than not. So the word to all of you is, whenever you're serving on a church council, and the word comes that you want to shorten the service for one reason or another, you take out one of the New Testament lessons and not the Old Testament lessons. Second thing I want to respond to with regard to Paul's material, Paul and I teach a course together, which we have somewhat presumptuously entitled God. And we've done that for 2 years so that we know something about one another, ways in which our concerns fit together. And I would just like to say this much, that I suppose it's in the material about God, where Old Testament reflection makes the greatest amount of connection with what Paul is saying. And if you're interested sometime, well, maybe we can talk about that, that I think the Old Testament will reinforce and give solid biblical basis for Paul's statements with regard to a limited God. And that with regard to issues of the knowledge of the future, God's limited knowledge of the future, with regard to God's limited power, and the limited ways in which God has chosen to respond to evil in the life of the world, there are considerable Old Testament materials that would serve as a biblical base for that conversation. So I can say that. That's enough.
We've got to go down the line here, sort of. You want to have the last word and the opening words? Okay. Well, perhaps it's of some use. You've come over here, and we should have something to say to you people. I think certainly not either gentle or justice to have to compete with a dance. Unless these are three golden oldies right here.
That's all right. He didn't look at me.
David is a couple years younger than I am. I've enjoyed very much working in the same program with David and Terry. It's really the case for me that I felt these men giving terrific biblical input to our conversation, and I've been able to feel that when I have my shot 5 times during the week, there's been so much said that's very supportive and very helpful. I don't know, I don't think this can be credited to the deans of the program here. I don't think they're that wise. I think, if anything, it's an argument for the doctrine of providence. More specifically, I've enjoyed very much their emphasis upon creativity, upon the complexity of the task and the importance of the task of carrying these materials, these biblical materials, into the contemporary period. I've heard David make distinctions very well between the Gospels. I've heard Terry talk about the updating of the law. I see in both of them a concern to move biblical materials forcefully, not violently, but forcefully into the contemporary discussion with creativity, with a strong emphasis upon creativity. Just a word about each of them then. I'm very interested in David's concern for the recognition of the distinction between the various biblical perspectives. I think that's a very important thing. I have an interest in the same sort of thing within theology. I think there are different ways even to be a Lutheran, for example. All Lutherans are not the same. To have this recognition, Luther and Paul are probably not the same in many important respects, for example. There's some famous articles on that. So I think that recognition of pluralism is very important. If I were to ask David a question, it would be this, I think. How do you know when someone comes to you with a question, which of the biblical themes or materials to draw upon? That is, if someone comes and asks you a question about the Gospel of John, you know what to say and so on. Is it the context? Is it context specific? But with a matter such as law, for example, the responses from the five bodies of material seem to be somewhat different, importantly different. So how would you know? How would you settle that? I'm just really curious. I'm not asking for Paul or John or Mark or Luke now, but for David. You've been scrupulous about trying to give these people their own voice, but I want your voice. I know you have indicated some of that, but I would like to hear more on that. Quickly, Terry, I have prepared one question, but I thought of another one during your evening presentation. Listening to those law passages, or those passages from the prophets and the denunciation, and remembering the distinction that you reminded us of tonight between law as limit and law as instruction and law as indictment, I was wondering about the psychological question of how you change people. In the early presentation, you seemed to emphasize sort of a natural law approach for the beginning of the week, where it really makes sense to obey the law because it will go well with you. But now I heard these other tones tonight, very sharp, very harsh. I'm wondering if you preached that way to me, what would happen? Would it change? Or is that just a heightened form of the concept? I mean, is it dramatizing for us? What will happen? So that it's just the other side of the instruction. I think the question was asked from over here somewhere was an interesting one. It almost seems as if one is enjoying just chewing these people out. Just sort of the exaltation of that. And I think you, I believe you, and I would suspect the Old Testament material are interested in changing people, and not just chewing them out. How do we change people? Is finally that law's instruction and kind of a natural adaptive, the base point? That's not a well-formulated question, but I think maybe you can get the drift. Those are the two questions.
I'd like to just observe for you what I see to be a common theme running through something we're all doing. And it's not necessarily a theme of content so much as a theme of style. From the moment I met Terry, whom I met before I met Paul, I sensed a real soul brother. From the moment I heard you lecture, I responded the same way. And I've been extraordinarily struck by the qualities in them that are common to something I work at in the biblical materials, and that is the matter of integrity. Now, I think what Terry has been doing with the Old Testament, the focus to me has been on moral integrity. And the way he has read and carefully chosen and read those passages to them and commented on us and rooted that in the nature of God makes inescapable, unless we work really hard at it, the importance of our grappling with being honest with ourselves about who we really are in terms of our wealth, our power, our role as Americans. You have read that Old Testament to us as if it is immediately directed to our situation. And we just, when you stop, we just in silence for a while because it just is a lot to take in and you they're doing along with the biblical materials. And I hear Paul in virtually every line he states. If you watch both these people in their physical gestures, they both talk with their whole bodies. They're just all in there.
Right, you are.
I'm not. Paul, how many times have you said in the course of your lectures, now you could make this move, but that won't work. Because intellectually you won't be really honest with either yourself or with all the facts. Now what does it mean to have faith in the modern world? To start with, you got to really be honest. And my question to you was, at one point, when you really pursue the questions of faith like this, don't you really honestly risk the possibility that you might end up with not faith because you have a larger commitment in some sense even to the truth? And you responded, well, I mean, everything you said was an expression of that kind of intellectual integrity, which is not easy. That is not easy. And I think in many ways the mark of what I try to do with the biblical materials is to try to really honestly look at what's there and not make it what we want it to be. Or try to put it all together so it's neat. Or try to cover over the contradictions or the things that are strange or that we don't like. So that there's really a measure of honesty in our struggle with the text and our willingness to call ourselves into question and the assumptions we bring to it about what Scripture is or about what's being said here or what it is addressing to us personally. That we're willing to call ourselves into question at every point and be honest about what we do. I'd like to just briefly say that when I was about 14 or 15, I had a most marvelous personal experience of the love of God that granted me enormous energy to love when I was young. It was, no way was it anywhere of my own making. It was total gift. But when I was in college, I studied philosophy. And I struggled with philosophy, trying to see if my way of thinking about God would hold water. And in my senior year, I lost it all. I was an atheist because I could no longer honestly believe about the world what I believed about the world and about God, the way I had imagined God. And the dissipation of my emotional energy from God, that earlier experience, dissipated. And I had no idea where this was going to end up. I graduated from college and went to seminary an atheist because I was determined that I was going to give religion a chance like I'd given philosophy a chance. That was honest too. And some people, when they study the historical Jesus, get their faith torn down. I wasn't even sure the man even existed when I started studying. When I was in England, I had an emotional experience of meaninglessness and emptiness that was equivalent to the power of the earlier religious experience. The mark of my faith today, I think, comes out of that struggle with the biblical text. That I tried to let those texts speak to me in ways that weren't going to be easy, but that I was going to be honest with. And my long track of recovering my Christianity, of recovering more than Christianity in many ways, but the richness of what I see in the biblical materials, has come, I think, from that initial willingness to be subverted, even if it meant a loss of everything. And I'm convinced now that my willingness to be an atheist was an act of faith. There's more faith in honest doubt than in all the creeds. I can only say that in retrospect. When you're in the middle of it, you don't know where you're going. Now, so I am not only willing but eager to be subverted because I know I'm going to grow. And my question to each of you, which you can think about and maybe answer, not answer if you like, is just for my own knowledge, to know you better and for anybody's benefit, what might have been the source of that integrity in your life?
We have to decide whether we speak more now or when others speak.
What would you like to do?
Let's go.
I'd like to hear your answer.
Yeah. Well, I'd be glad to kind of answer that. I don't think I have a comparably dramatic pair of illustrations. I think in my case,
you were listening tonight, David. You were listening.
I bet I won't multiply, though.
Well, then we can.
Well, I don't have one or two instances of that sufficient, of that kind of dramatic import. I don't. But one thing that flows into my work with you folks this week has been my own family of origin, and I think that is, even though I don't live with those people now, I think that's a continuing factor of great importance. I hope it's not too personal to mention. We were not of one mind regarding matters of faith. My dad was a person who could not confess the Christian faith. He was a person who was troubled by the problem of suffering, the problem of evil. He was troubled by the hypocrisy of the preachers he knew, by the ineptness of the church on many questions. And my mother, on the other hand, was, I think, as close to a saint, and I don't mean by saint simply a forgiven sinner, but someone who is living the Christian life, if I may use that rather older definition, as I can imagine. I don't think she and he ever worked those things out very well together. I think that they just were different, and they could not find a reconciliation. The children then also went in different directions. I remember many conversations around the dinner table, back and forth, where the one person would try to lean either gently or aggressively on the other person. I have a brother who is a pastor in the Lutheran Church, and another brother who is very active in the church. I have two sisters and a third brother who are not involved in the church. It's 3-3, you see. And that's been a very important factor in my life, that personal struggle. And of course, as you go on, you meet many others. So to want to deal seriously with that issue and not to act in such a way as to somehow imply that either the Christian or the non-Christian is stupid or simply hasn't thought about issues. The Christian faith is a strong contender, but it is shot through with ambiguity. And the Christian church is often not the best argument on behalf of Christian faith, as we've been talking about. So I think that's the kind of personal background that would speak to your question. As for me, I think, though I, in that 3-3 count, I counted myself on the side of Christian faith. I believe I am a Christian. I want to be a Christian. Yet, certainly, the questions that my brother and sisters put to me and my dad, and then many others now, are right in there for me. I have no trouble internalizing it.
I've got stories like you here, though. I'm a third generation pastor in the pietistic tradition. My grandpa was a part of the old Haugie Church, Haugie Honor. My father and mother were graduates of the Lutheran Bible Institute. I grew up in a home, oldest of four boys, where a life of devotion, issues of lifestyle, were very, very much a part of all that we were. So I suppose that I'd have to look to that pietism. I'm amazed, as I look at many of my compatriots who have grown up in comparable homes, I'm amazed that my rebellion was as slight as it was. I've certainly seen that, particularly some of the legalism of my family has not been very helpful. But I continue to be animated and energized, particularly by the God in whom they believe. A God who was not distant, a God who was very much involved in their lives, a God to whom they prayed and he was as close as the upstairs, a God who walked with them every step of the way. There's something there, there's really something there. And while they may not have examined as thoroughly and critically as they might have some of the implications of that piety, I'm trying to go after some of it because I think there's a lot of important material there for the life of Christians and every pastor.
Seems to me it's just open season. That's not too military metaphor.
Well, I'd like David to answer the question you asked. Is there any unity in the biblical test, the New Testament testimony? Partly because that one question I want to ask. I believe that I'm convinced that the biblical scholar myself, but you know, from what you said, it's hit or a variety of testimonies. Yet there's a bewilderment, you know.
Will the
real Jesus
stand up
and you help show him who he is and what
it's worth? I would get, like to get my answer to that question, but I'd also like you to be thinking about what your answer is going to be, because I'm going to ask you this. I guess when you say, will the real Jesus please stand up, I don't think in terms of any one of the gospel records of the four gospels. Sort of which one do you choose, and this one's right and the others aren't quite right. Nor do I think it is possible to take all four and combine them into one. I mean, there are just too many contrary depictions of the character of Jesus. All through the Gospel of Mark, he hides his identity. The disciples don't know who he is. In the Gospel of John, he tells who he is from the very beginning. The disciples look at him and say, oh, the Lamb of God. And it just, I mean, neither the disciples nor Jesus are the same characters, same people in those two stories. Now, I'm not eager to create problems for anybody, but there it stands. If I'm honest and I look at it, there it stands. And that's only the beginning of numerous kinds of conflicting, contradictory portrayals of characters, events, settings, sequence of events, and so on. Now, one shifts from doing what I was doing this week, which was primarily in terms of literary criticism. I was concerned to see how Mark portrayed Jesus, not whether it was all historically accurate, but how Mark portrayed or Luke portrayed or Matthew portrays. I wasn't even asking the historical question in a sense. I was assuming that some base was there and that these were portraying them. I wanted to see what each was. I think then I have to completely shift ground and ask the question now as a historian. That is a very important question. And then I say, well, I have four contradictory testimonies here. What do I do with this? And then the whole process begins of functioning as a historian where one says, first of all, now each of these writers did not have the same sense that we have of recording history. Their primary understanding was not that they were literally recording every word and every event as it actually happened, it's clear from the way the gospel writers used the material that they depended on that they were free to shape that material, add, take away, rearrange, rewrite in such a way as to bring out the true meaning of that event. So that if you were to say to Paul, what is Jesus about? Paul might say, well, let me write you a letter or an essay. But if you ask one of the gospel writers, what Jesus is about, he says, let me tell you a story. See, now, the story isn't necessarily literally accurate in every sense, although for the most part, it's rooted in history. But there's a freedom there to tell the story so as to bring out the real meaning of it as the author understands it. Now, our problem is that we have to use documents that were not written to be historical records, and we have to assess them as historical records. Therein lies the difficulty, because they were not meant in that sense. They were story sermons. The earliest Christians apparently expected that the end of the world would come very soon. They're not writing for posterity, they're writing to transform people, and they're going to use all the rhetoric and the story skills at their hands to do that. Now, there's 40 years between Jesus and the writing of the first gospel, 70, 80 between the others, the death of Jesus and the others. A lot has happened if we have no records between Franklin Delano Roosevelt and our own time. And now we write something down. There's a problem with the distance there. So historians attempt to take the traditions using a numerous criteria for what might have been historical, what might have been added along the way. And as you can see from what I did this week, so you say something is historically inaccurate. That doesn't mean you dismiss it. You see it as a part of that author's way of portraying Jesus, and it conveys a deep meaning in that context. But now what do? Which Jesus do you choose? The one reconstructed by the historian Norman Perrin, or Mark Borg, or six or eight other historians who are attempting to reconstruct. Well, there's a danger in this, in the sense that we think, well, if we've really found the final voice of Jesus, then we don't have to take the other things so seriously. And you start looking for a sort of a canon within the canon. Well, I don't have to pay too much attention to that because Jesus didn't really say that. He really said this. Therefore, this is important. So I'm real cautious about that kind of thing. So I think we have to go about a historical reconstruction where we honestly try to say, what did Jesus really say or do? I think, for example, many of the gospel writers have rewritten the story in light of the events that took place after. Jesus is looking forward, not knowing what's going to happen, and we think he was proclaiming the kingdom of God, whereas the gospel writers are often proclaiming Jesus. And he was trying to reform the nation. A church came out of it. So the later writers are in some sense rewriting what they understand, saying, well, Jesus must have meant this, since this is what happened. And we have to go back and try to reconstruct what really happened. Now, I haven't answered the question that you had about the limits of the canon. What was your first question? This, I'm doing an awful thing here. The worst thing you can do to discourage questions is give long answers.
Well, where's the unity in the multiplicity?
Okay, the unity in the multiplicity. Well, I'll have to be honest with you that I see unity in the fact of these people's response to a central historical figure. And I see some common motifs, such as love, but it takes a different shape in each one. You can't say it's the same in each one. And I personally am not at the point in this where I'm ready to say what the unity is, as if I could make some common statement. I'm still moving out in terms of trying to understand the unique response of each one.
The same question was addressed to me as with regard to the different functions of the law, instruction, limit, indictment. The question came from a systematician. You have to all realize that, okay? When a question like that comes from a systematic professor, you understand that what they're after is one of those molecular structures like you see in front of chemistry buildings, where everything fits together. So,
you're a
structure theorist.
I hope so.
I think that one has to make a distinction between a unity of thought and unity of experience. I think that there are individuals who need the law, the material with regard to the poor and the oppressed as indictment. There are people in certain life situations who need it as instruction. There are certain person situations who need it as limit. I may, in my own life experience, need a word at one moment, one word at one moment. 3 weeks from now, I may need another word. And so there's a sense in which the diversity of my own life experience, I think, propels me not to put everything finally together. I was interested in your question coming out of the discussion this evening. You were immediately on to the instruction. You went quickly from the indictment to the instruction, and the questions which seemed to animate you were instruction. I probably didn't deal with them in the way that I should have, but the prophetic word is the word of indictment, I think, almost fully. That's the word for that situation. That's the word for that occasion. So that's the way in which I would respond to that.
I think the only thing I could add, you wanted something from the two of us, and sharing it for me. I think that I would want to proceed. Maybe you would find this going farther than you'd want to go, but you've spoken to a commitment to a kind of process of struggling with that sheer particular Jesus. I mean, there's a response in each of these four or five ways to that figure, as the kind of apodictic particular there, but not specifying a particular structure of response. You've got several options, clearly, and you've emphasized the situational difference. Some people need this kind of use of law, and others need this kind. I guess the only thing I would add to answer my own question, which is what I think we're trying to answer now. What do you do if somebody comes, remember the question? What do you do if somebody comes to you? I think that I would want to try to go as carefully and fully as I could into the question the person's asking. And what shape of reality is implied in the question? What struggle, what predicament, what promise, what prospect? Now, there's a danger, of course, again, that I might never get back to the biblical text. I'm sure that if somebody asks me on the way to the bathroom, I won't consult Exodus. You know, I mean, there are some questions for which the Bible is a poor book as an answer book.
You know the text about Moses and the constipation. Moses took two tablets and left them in the hills.
But can I tell you which hill? I guess so, but maybe the difference. We are not three carbon copies. You know, there's a difference here. I think it's not just that I want. I hope it isn't that I want a sort of singular truth that will stand there shining, resplendent. You know, I don't think so. But I guess maybe I'm concerned to deal with some sort of dialogue with the person who is asking that question, as well as with the text. And I don't think either of you would deny that. That was clear in your response.
But you say you don't want. Now, my question is, it seems to me that, for example, that the way I think, I will experience the world to a great extent in terms of the way I think about the world. If I think of the world as alive with all kinds of spiritual realities, I will experience the world that way. If I do not think of the world as alive with all kinds of spiritual realities, or I'm seeing the world from a radical perspective of identity with the poor, I will experience the world that way. Now, I'm not... there are all kinds of things. You know, we've talked about symbols. You talked about symbol systems. I would agree with that. That there's sort of a perspective of a symbol system. And what I'm finding difficult is, and I'm not sure I even want to do it, but I'm finding it difficult to do it, where to sort of find an overarching system that encompasses the varieties of ways in which a person might legitimately, or a group might legitimately experience the world. So I'm wanting to engage a variety of models. And I'm not wanting to choose one, let somebody else choose another. I'm wanting to experience the world out of a variety of models to enhance the richness of my experience of the world.
Right. Well, you can't be all things, I suppose. You can't experience. One of the Gospels is closer to you than another. I bet that's true.
Well, I know one a little bit better.
Okay. Why did you choose to memorize that one first?
It was short.
Okay. That's a reasonable skeptical answer.
But you're right. You're right. I think there are dominant models.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I'm closest to the Gospel of Mark. But on the other hand, I don't know whether you heard me talking about some of you heard me talking about John today. You know, that's a dimension, a way of experiencing the world that's very different from Mark. I don't want to lose that. But I don't want to somehow try to put Mark and John together and collapse what's sort of unique about the holistic way of experiencing the world this way.
I think it's very good to have the perspectives and dialogue. I think that's what you do so well. I guess one thing I would want to say is that I don't think there are, let me start making a positive sentence. I think that there are rudimentary experiences which are not yet formulated in specifically Luke and Mark and Matthew and Johannine ways. I think there is some sense in which if the gospel is good news, it's good news to that situation, so that you want to trust the situation rather extensively, and then find the appropriate word that seems to fit that situation. That there's always a risk that the situation shapes the text then, but I think there's confidence that God is at work in that situation, calling us into it. So I would go forward with some good courage, I think, in that respect.
An illustration from the Old Testament then. Be helpful. The whole issue of true and false prophecy, which animated Israel for a couple of centuries at least, one of the most basic criterion that arose with regard to distinguishing true from false was whether or not the word that was spoken fit the situation. And it would be true to say that if the language of Amos that we were sounding tonight again and again, if that language had been spoken by 2nd Isaiah into the situation of the exile, instead of the word which he did speak, which was, "Comfort, comfort ye my people, says the Lord, for the Lord has forgiven you double for all your sins." Amos spoken his word into that situation, you've been a false prophet. And so you have Amos and 2nd Isaiah together in the same canon. The word of Amos, you don't speak that on the bedside of a dying Christian. I'd be
excited. This is really quite a pragmatic test, isn't it? I mean, it's the consequence you're talking about. Does it bless the person? Does it change the person? Does it nurture the person?
Yeah. The situation, one of the great virtues of the biblical material is that it comes from such a variety of human situations and arises out of such a variety of human situations. The Book of Psalms alone as an illustration of the variety of situations, and the better you know your scriptures, the better you will able, in a given life situation, be able to go to the text that really speak.
But you won't be able to do it if you don't study the situation.
You've got to study both the situation and the text. You've got to get both.
If I'd had an individual dialogue with individual people, I might have picked one of these and related to it. But what I ended up doing was, I said, now here's given the way of looking at the world in the Book of Revelation, of Paul, of John, of Luke, of Matthew, Mark, here's the perspective I think they might have had on the struggle one has as a student. So that the resources become available to them to think in a variety of ways to apply what would most fit or speak to them, which would be another way of dealing with it, instead of you picking what speaks most, provide the variety available and let the person relate it to their situation.
Question about pedagogy. It occurs to me that it's been an impressively rich week with three of you here. And one of the ways in which it's been rich is that the three of you, in some sense, two of you actually, and the three of you put together, represent three of the sort of usual five departments of the seminary, right? So that in fact we've gotten 3/5 of seminary education in 1 week here. It's only a painless way to do that. I guess I'm asking a question about the other 2/5, or about whatever else is missing. That is, if we've got an Old Testament, a New Testament, and a systematic person in front of us, what is it that as lay people, lay Christians, or clergy, that we haven't got? What questions do you hear not raised out of the three contexts? Where's the evidence? And what are the glaring gaps as you think about what you've heard each other do this week?
One obvious gap, I think, is the lack of careful attention to the church historical material. I don't do that well. I'm interested in the contemporary period. I'm not very interested. I mean, that's a confession of sin, I guess. But I've never enjoyed studying history, and I enjoy doing what I enjoy doing. So I want to be knowledgeable, but it's harder for me to do it with enthusiasm. But I think it would add a lot. I mean, intellectually, I can recognize that we've skipped over. I mean, there's a couple of years between the Bible and our efforts to try to relate to the present age. And I think we just overleaping that is a serious weakness, especially if one had thought. It comes more against me than it does against these guys. If you had thought that you were trying to deal responsibly, I hope no one has thought that I've been trying to offer the sort of what the church has taught through the ages, but what the church must try to do now. That's been my concern. But I think I would add a lot. The fifth, of course, is a whole area of pastoral, homiletics, worship, Christian. Some of that is done elsewhere, you know, down the hill. Is that down? In the worship services.
Rich Anderson has provided the pastoral counseling side of things here.
So we've had the whole seminary curriculum.
Yeah. We may not have had the church history stuff.
Not so much church history.
Be interesting to think of it in terms of the question of the commonality of integrity that I talked about, to think of church history in a way as a history of the way in which every age has attempted to struggle with integrity, to understand and to express, to be faithful to the faith and faithful to what they know of the world of their age or what situation.
I think there's another thing, Jody, that seems important to me, and we do illustrate three disciplines, and maybe too well. Because it seems to me the human situation doesn't belong to any discipline. The gospel doesn't belong to any discipline. Life doesn't. We can have much too much disciplinary consciousness. And I hope we haven't illustrated that. We need each other desperately. In our seminary, there's a move toward much more interdisciplinary work. That's still the discipline, but at least they're talking to each other.
A recent article, John Cobb, talked about disciplinology, where in theological education, one of the major problems has been that particularly with the expansion of knowledge in each of the disciplines, that we've had to burrow our way so deeply into each of our disciplines that we end up not talking very well to other people. And I think in particularly in theological seminary, that's crucial that people begin to talk across disciplines, because the pastor's being can't be expected to put everything together. We have to provide, I think, some of that cross-fertilization. Less fragmentation in the training process.
Obviously not a malady unique to theological education. Understand?
Inspector?
Yeah. The question's been turning around. I resisted asking it, but I'll risk it, partly because I'm not sure I can articulate it clearly. I've not been in dialogue with any of you, so I'm a bit nervous about it. The question may be posed a couple of different ways. What difference does it make? How important is it that the church as a whole have the correct theology, even all radical, a correct understanding of many of these things? To what extent does correct theology, correct understanding, bear on the salvation of a soul or salvation of a people, or a salvation of the world. Now, some of your earlier responses spoke somewhat to that, and that was the second reason I hesitated to ask for it.
I'd love to talk to it.
Struggle a bit.
Make a stab at it. I know Terry David has something to say about it, but it seems to me in some ways it's the emphasis on correct theology may become a little more of me. I think the work a little with your word salvation, sozomai, to be made whole, wholeness of life, shalom, and Terry has made the point very emphatically that this has a this worldly richness, especially in the Old Testament. David in his Johannine material today was emphasizing not the future but the present in the meaning of eternal life. Well, I certainly think one's thought, one's mind, doubles back and affects one's behavior, one's feeling, one's relationship to others. If Terry's hypothesis is right, that which is stated a little more fully in his recent book, Suffering of God, that we do sort of model our image of leadership and image of ministry after our doctrine of God. You know, if God is one way, well, I probably should be that way. The pastor speaks for God, after all. The Christian speaks for God, doesn't she? So I think the conceptions you have of God are going to double back. Moreover, if your particular theology, there are some obvious examples that we've been talking about this, fairly obvious and yet important, where if your theology diverts you, defines salvation itself more narrowly, then that will make a terrific impact on your connectedness with the rest of humankind. As a person believes in his or her heart, so is that person. Our lives are shaped by our faith, and our faith includes our thinking. So I want to go after those people's minds. I don't want to give them up. And I think if I get at them, I'll be affecting their lives.
That's a very nice answer. So he was. I could only stress the images of God. I think it's the feminists in our midst over the last couple of decades in particular have impressed upon us how the maleness of our God talk and our God language, the language, has in fact issued in leadership styles, behaviors more generally, that have not been truly representative of who our God is and what our faith is about. And I think the heart of that is the images of God with which we work. That's just particularizing that concern of Paul's voice even a little bit more.
I'd like to respond by saying that totally apart from life after death. The question is whether religious dimension of life is constitutively important or necessary for human existence. Can we survive without the resources of love or peace or a new conception of power granted us through the religious dimension of what it means to be human in community? And that God, to put it a different way, if that's the case, God is concerned about the salvation of the whole world, not me in isolation. The issue is not whether I go to heaven or not. The issue is what happens to the world. And the problem is that I am always sucking things back into my self-centered humanness. And I need to hear what Terry says when he reads those scriptures that call me to a perspective that is dealing with the world, for we, none of us may survive.
You know, it's now 9:30, and the band is warmed up, and the ice cream line is low. Isn't that persuasive?
Yeah.
We'll be happy.
If people don't vacate, I'd like to follow up with another question. The question.
One more.
Okay, that's it.
The question that I heard about, does Christianity or does faith make you different? I'm kind of sitting on the edge of my chair as I hear you talk about family systems, the context of a passage, the context of my life, the context of my journey. But then it seems to be tethered in abruptly when you speak of at least a word from the Bible. When you speak of what does a text or a passage mean? When I ask the question, when I hear the question, well, what does the text mean? It's kind of like, well, if I finally get that truth, capital T, of what it means, then we can write the last commentary on that passage for all kinds of good, But if instead I ask, not what does the text mean, but how does it function? What does it do? All of a sudden, it opens sociological dimension, which accesses political dimension, economic dimension. All of a sudden, the text, instead of being defined or find a word in some commentary on a shell, the text has hope. It is life. I feel hope.